House Interim Committee on Revenue will come to order. Colleagues, we have a long afternoon of reports and a variety of other issues that are coming before us, so I wanted to get started at as close to the normal time as we could, and I noticed that, in fact, given people in the back of the room, we actually have a quorum. And with that, we'll open the informational meeting on committee bill draft discussion. I'll simply say that Paul Warner, Dr. Warner, and I have looked at the issues that are facing the committee, tried to come up with some bill draft ideas that we think give us the maximum flexibility, and he's going to describe them for us.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome, members. The concepts we've been working on are pretty rough at this stage, but the idea is to maintain some flexibility for you and what will occur in the session. The first is around general tax credit with a relating clause of probably tax expenditures. We know we have a couple of technical issues involved. They're really non-policy issues, but cleanup. One is around the bovine credit and how carry forwards are handled. Another one is around the working family credit and the definition of income. So those are the two kind of things we picked up in discussions with Department of Revenue. But we would also have this other issues that come along that you may want to deal with and that would fit under a tax expenditure relating clause. We would have that available to you. The second general concept is around general property tax cleanup. We have a couple of issues that have work groups going on them. One is on an issue you've talked a lot is property taxation of nonprofits. So we will have a relating clause to property for property taxes. We've also been looking at the in lieu of property tax payments for solar property, and there's some suggestions for some modifications to that. Again, this would be a general property tax type cleanup bill. And the third thing is very much wide open. We're looking at something around just estate finance for contingency. From what might come up, the biggest risk we see out there, and it'll be the thing we'll start talking about on the agenda, is federal tax reform,
right,
and what that might mean for you in terms of what it might mean for the budget this biennium, but also in terms of the policy issues that'll come up for you. And then right now it's kind of hard to tell what those will be. There's quite a bit of differences between the House and Senate proposals so far. So, but those could well begin to emerge or could be finalized by the time you come in February. We have the Senate will be introducing a bill that will be relating to Reconnect. So you have a separate Reconnect bill, and maybe it's just a technical bill that you normally have, but we wanted you to have something that would allow you to have a policy response if that's necessary, if the landscape changes enough. So that's what we're thinking, and of course our deadline for getting those in is next Tuesday.
Okay. So we've thought a fair amount about this, and as you can see, it's fairly vague. Some of the ideas that you have probably will fit within these relating clauses, but some of them might not. And I would very much welcome comments from committee members on these ideas, alternate ideas, and potential amendments that we might offer in order to flesh out these bills as time develops. Some of you, of course, might be considering bills of your own that have to do with revenue in some form or another, and that's certainly accepted and appropriate. But I want to make sure that the committee bills, since we only have allowed a few, are give us the maximum flexibility to respond to conditions that may not yet have happened. You probably know that when we pass a limitation like the one we passed in rule about how many bills a committee could introduce, I have always told the Speaker, I know we're going to need more bills, but I won't know until the middle of January what they are, because something will come up between now and then. And she smiles and shakes her head, and then we always ask for bills in the middle of January because something new has happened. But anyway, that's where we are. So any comments now? Certainly you can approach me or Paul later as well. If not, let's go ahead to our second item, implications of repealing federal, state, and local tax deduction.
Okay. Chris is coming up. We have this actually spilled over to your September meeting. We had put together some data from the IRS on Oregonians who use the SALT deduction, the state and local tax deduction. And so I'm going to go through that with you very quickly. And then I have another piece, kind of a background piece on what's called balance of payments, which is the flow of expenditures from the federal government as opposed to the flow of tax revenue back from Oregon to the federal government, just to give you some perspective. Chris has been working, going through the 429-page House tax plan from the House Ways and Means Committee. So we'll have some, he's done some work on that. He's got some orders of magnitude things to look at for you. And so when we get through this, Chris will do that and try to answer any questions. Of course, the federal plan, as you know, is very much in flux. So the first thing is just the rationale for it. Now, this is the rationale if we were advisors to the House Ways and Means Tax panel. And from a federal government standpoint, remember that what happens when they allow deductibility of state and local taxes, that in effect reduces the federal revenue. And in a sense, they're picking up a share of our tax burden through that deductibility. I mean, it's a type of partial exporting. And so from their standpoint, they would see that as, well, this would be something that we could afford to not do. Already, the alternative minimum, which has been in place for a couple of decades now, those that fall under the alternative minimum tax, the first thing you lose, the first deduction you lose, are your SALT deduction. So people have, in effect, that are influenced by the alternative minimum tax have not been using that deduction for some time. And finally, of course, the whole federal plan, and according to the CBO estimates that we've seen, are looking at $1.5 to $1.8 trillion reduction in net revenue over a 10-year period. So this is their revenue raiser piece within that overall plan, which is primarily revenue reductions through rate reductions. And remember, those don't affect us directly. They could affect us indirectly through the federal tax subtraction, but they don't affect us directly. So now if we look at our Oregon taxpayers, we went through the 2015 IRS statistics. These are from Oregon taxpayers. And you can see that and in terms of the filers, about 673,000, which is about 36%, did use the SALT deduction on their federal return, and they deducted about $8.5 billion. Not surprisingly, the biggest one is income taxes because of our income tax system. Interestingly, we also had 3,400 people who used the sales tax deduction. And remember, that's one of the options that you have at the federal level is you can use it either or sales taxes or income taxes. So you can't use both, but you have to choose.
What's sales tax?
So the sales taxes are probably residents of Washington who pay Oregon taxes through their earnings and through their wages in Oregon, but then they have a calculation to pay more in sales taxes.
Okay.
So, but the other thing, if you look at, I'll show you some numbers about the different states. Even states that have sales taxes that are pretty close in total size to our income tax, we would have a lot more deductibility because, remember, sales taxes are back-loaded to lower-income households, many of whom don't itemize.
Right.
So income tax, high-income taxpayers are more likely to itemize, and so we use the deduction. Real estate taxes or property taxes, and you can see about $2.4 billion is deducted. So for a total of state and local taxes of $8.5 billion in deduction. So that's deductions, not tax revenue, but deductions. So now if you look at the distribution among taxpayers, again, this kind of raises that point about you got to itemize in order to use the SALT deduction. And it's primarily concentrated in the 75 and above 1,000 taxpayers, the biggest group being the 100 to 200,000. And they're about 31% of the total. And then also the 200 to 500,000. So that's where the bulk of the SALT deduction users are. Of course, their income taxes are higher, and they're more likely to itemize.
Hmm. Interesting.
So now if you look at the next slide, there's an interesting interaction with the alternative minimum. As I said, what the alternative minimum does in a very convoluted way, if you've ever had to figure it out, they take away those SALT deductions, and then you add them back, in effect, what you would get on your Schedule A. So, but you can see it's predominantly higher income. There is kind of a window there, predominantly in the 200 to 500,000 group who are mostly affected by the ATM. Once you, and Chris, I know, has shown you some numbers on this. Once your income gets high enough, then your rates start to kick in and you get out of the AMT. So if you're out of the AMT, then you'd be back into full deductibility. So you can see where how that's distributed predominantly in higher income groups that are affected by the alternative minimum. So one way of looking at this is that, okay, if you take away the SALT deduction, these folks are already mostly not getting it. So they're a little less affected. You'll see how we compare with other states on that in a kind of interesting way. So if you look at kind of a combination of things and comparing us with some of our neighbors, our SALT deduction is, not surprisingly, above average, 7% of AGI compared to 5.3% for U.S. average. And that's, again, because of our tax structure, predominantly the personal income tax. Notice, however, that the percentage of our taxpayers that use the AMT is only equal to the national average. And what that's telling you is we have fewer people in those higher income groups. So that offsets some of that. Even though we got the high income tax, which would tend to push you into the AMT, we're still only average. Mm. So that means that our taxpayers will be disproportionately affected by elimination of the SALT because we use it a lot and we're not already losing it because of the AMT. A state, though, that's clearly impacted more is California. They have 7.9% of their AGI through the SALT deduction, and then they've got 4.7% because they've got high income taxes, they have a very high top marginal rate, and they got a lot of high rollers. So they're going to be most affected, but you can see they're way above the national average on use of the AMT. So that gives you a sense. Washington, for example, even though their income is higher than ours, and they use the sales tax deduction, but again, sales taxpayers less likely to be itemizers. Also notice that they get 10% are deducting the income tax, meaning they're paying the income tax in other states, probably some part of your residence. So again, you see where the national average is. A state like Idaho, for example, Nevada especially has a low SALT deduction because they don't have an income tax. So that gives you a sense of kind of where we are in terms of the deduction. And then we looked at some analysis done that was in state tax notes by states and what impact is. And you can see the percent reduction in after-tax income through the SALT deduction for Oregon is about 0.9%. That's slightly above the U.S. average. California is quite a bit above because of that AMT effect. And then Washington, Idaho, and Nevada are all below the national average in terms of impact. There's estimated about 29% of our taxpayers are affected. Remember, 36% were affected on the returns. The difference there are those that are already affected through the AMT. And the average federal tax increase would be $573. So those will be people, your constituents, they'll have a tax increase caused by this. Now, of course, this is one piece of what the proposals are, so we're not saying that people are going to have a net increase. We're just saying this aspect of it will increase.
Yeah, question. Yes.
All right, thank you. All right, so maybe I'm not getting this. So I understand it's going to increase the burden by $573, but I thought I understood from previous slide it's only top income earners that are probably going to experience that, right, because we don't have as many high rollers, I think it was the expression you used 3 minutes ago, in our state. And then a lot of folks are just going to apply for the alternative minimum. And so, I mean, it is a tax increase. I should be careful here. I don't think I represent a lot of rich people in my district. But it's only going to be, it's going to be an increase on people that I might argue have the ability to pay.
Yes.
Is that what these slides are telling me?
Yes, there are two factors that will get you that will affect you. That is your own state and local taxes you pay, and so taxpayers in your district could have high property taxes, as well as pay high income taxes for a relative amount of income. So, but you still have to be one of that 36% of taxpayers who itemize. So you're probably going to be in that top third to be affected by this.
Okay.
One of the reasons why all these tables have to go together is that the system is so complicated now. To understand what the effect of a change is on any particular taxpayer, you have to go through all of those tables. Does somebody itemize? What's their income, and how is that related to the fact that they itemize? Do they pay an alternative minimum tax after having itemized? If you don't pay that if you're not itemizing, or do you? And then what does this mean in terms of actual effect? And of course, when you look at these estimated average federal income tax increase on the second to the last slide, those are after all those adjustments. Some people will actually have a decrease in their taxes. Other people will increase a lot more than $573. I think you almost have to have an individual's tax return in order to figure out what this means for an individual, don't you?
That's right, Mr. Chair. And the other great simplifying thing is here, we're only looking at the SALT deduction. We're not including and that interaction with the alternative minimum and current federal law. We're not looking at things like, for example, a piece of the House proposal is to increase the standard deduction. And that would mean a lot of people would not even be using itemized deductions because they would be using the standard deduction if that increase goes through. So you've got those kind of interactions. And then, of course, from the federal standpoint, they're proposing lower rates. So you may pay more because of the SALT, but then on net, you end up with lower rates, lower tax liability. So, yeah, it's a very complex interaction. So that's why you're getting interesting conversations in the Capitol.
Representative Benz?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul, isn't it correct to say that as a high-income, all we have is an income tax state, the share, if you will, of our tax burden that the federal government's been picking up by virtue of allowing this deduction is going to reduce, and thus we in the high-income tax state will be bearing likely more of the burden of this increase than would be the case in a lower-income tax state. Is that a correct statement?
Yes, Vice Chair Benz, if we use, you can see that chart we use the SALT more than the typical state as a percentage of our taxable income, so we will be disproportionately affected by that SALT deduction, whereas the states like Nevada that have a lower state and local taxes their taxes, many of which are severance taxes or gross gaming receipts taxes, are not, don't show up on there as a deductible tax.
I feel like another times in my life following our state's tax system, part of what I understood is that we are a tax giver as opposed to a tax receiver, in that federal programs, we don't have a military base, we don't tend to get, we pay more in taxes to the federal government than we sort of receive in commiserate services under this situation, if I'm following right, it just makes it worse then.
Representative Nose, Mr. Chair, I do have a document in Lowellis that I'll go through in just a minute, which is with the best update I've seen on that balance of payments. And I'll show you what the latest is. It was really done by the Rockefeller Center in New York. Very adversely affected by this change. But I'll show you what those numbers are in just a second. I'll just go through my conclusions, and those are on the last page there. And just to kind of summarize, the nature of our system does mean that a SALT deduction would disproportionately affect us. And I think that shows pretty clearly. One of the kind of weird consequences of choosing either sales taxes or income taxes to deduct, well, think if you had a perfectly balanced system where you had sales and income taxes were roughly the same. Well, you'd actually be penalized because you wouldn't be able to deduct a lower percentage of your taxes. So because we don't have a sales tax in that sense, we have more deductible. There's also this strong correlation with a SALT deduction because that puts you into the AMT, but the proportion for Oregon taxpayers is about equal. So that's kind of offset by our lower income that we have and fewer taxpayers that are actually fall into the SALT despite of our high income taxes. And then finally, the reason for looking at this as the SALT deduction or some of these elements, some of the things that Chris is going to talk about and you'll be looking at perhaps in February, it's important to keep in mind what these effects are on your taxpayers, because constituents will come forward and say, hey, I'm affected by it in this way, as particularly if some of the deductions are eliminated. So just those, I can see that as you getting a lot of questions on that. Okay. So the next thing I had was in reference to Representative Nosa's question is on the balance of payments. This is done from state policy reports. I'm not supposed to reproduce this. So
Representative Bass, please.
Mr. Hall, is it correct to say that given the fact that we are so reliant upon the income tax, this change, if it occurs, is going to make it that much more difficult for this state to contemplate increasing that income tax because the federal government is no longer picking up that share that it once did by virtue of this deduction?
Vice Chair Benz, some of that certainly could be the response, but it may also no longer be a factor influencing what type of tax you have. Now, as I said, with the income tax, income or sales tax, you can deduct it. Whereas if you can't deduct anything, it's not going to matter what tax you have. There's not going to be any exporting. They're going to have that same effective rate. So there could be some of that, too. I don't know.
Yep. Representative
Smith? No. Thank you. Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So far we're concentrating on the SA portion of SALT. We're not really talking about the local tax, which is the property tax piece of that. And if I understand correctly, that also would no longer be eligible for deduction.
Smith, Mr. Chair, there's a couple of things to that. One is, as members, we talked about this during session. There's not a state feedback on the state income tax, because you can't deduct your state income taxes and your state income taxes. But as part of our reconnect to federal law, Oregon allows you to deduct your property taxes on your state income taxes. So if the property tax deduction is eliminated, you will automatically connect to that.
Got it.
So then that has a feedback loop into our revenue, and Chris will talk about some numbers on that. Now also, remember, there's quite a different proposal coming from the House versus the Senate. The Senate is asking for full SALT elimination, whereas the House has the income tax elimination, but the property tax would have a $10,000 cap, which would make it moot for a lot of people, but there's still going to be some people who will be over that $10,000 cap. And you'd probably see regional differences within Oregon, be high tax areas, multiple people that own more than one home. But Chris will talk about that and some of those differences. But this, the state policy reports, if you look on page 3, this is the federal government used to go through and have a very detailed report of federal expenditures by state. It's not just federal funds, as we call them in the budget process, but defense spending, Social Security payments, all the payments going to the state. So it includes both of those, transfers to state and local governments and to individuals, too. So the feds discontinued this about 10 years ago, so we haven't gotten good data. New York's Rockefeller Center went through and updated these estimates. I have the full report if anybody's interested in that. But it's heavily focused on New York, of course, which is very adversely affected. But if you scroll down a little bit, you can see where Oregon is. Oregon is right about in the middle. If you look at the FY16, Oregon receives about $1.30 for every dollar in revenue. So we get 30 cents more back than we do. And some of the earlier terms that we looked at, Representative Nose was referring to earlier studies when the feds did it, we did tend to get in the 95, 98 cents. So we had less coming back than what we had going forward.
So it's changed.
It has changed. And one of the reasons, if you scroll down to the bottom, is maybe not such a good reason, that now the states on average get 18 cents back for every tax dollar they pay. And that's another way of saying the feds are running big deficits.
Structural problem for
yes. So that's not necessarily a good thing. But it does show, but if you look at Oregon, we're still above average, but and we're the dollar of 18, and we're 26th ranked among the states. So we're pretty much right in the middle in that terms of that balance of payments. And if you look at the next page there, you can see there's a chart showing our taxes. Our taxes, the average is at about $9,500. And we're about 8,700. You can see us down below the average. So we pay less in taxes than the typical state. There are two reasons for that. One is we've talked about with the SALT deduction. We make greater use of that. And the other is our per capita income is lower than the national average. So those two factors come into play.
So what? Sorry, Representative Barnum.
Yeah, yes.
So what?
Representative Ellis, please.
What has North Dakota and Wyoming got going for it? I mean, they're small states. I'm not surprised to see Connecticut up there, or Massachusetts, or New Jersey, or New York. Who knows?
Connecticut, Massachusetts, New Jersey, they're all relatively high income. New York. North Dakota and Wyoming have a lot of mining income, severance tax income, royalties.
Okay.
So I think that's what's showing up there and paying federal taxes on that.
South
I think
Dakota
they
would
be
the same then.
They have very low, I don't think Wyoming has very low income taxes and sales taxes, so getting most of their revenue through those severance taxes, so they have very small SALT deductions. You can see California is
lower than I thought.
Yeah, is in terms of taxes, but they're also, if you look on that next chart there, they have the second biggest negative balance. Texas is the biggest, and California's second.
Oh, okay.
And then the next page shows the other side of the federal spending received, and you can see that we're pretty close to the national average, slightly below on that. So the bottom line is we're below average in terms of tax dollars, but also below average in terms of spending, but we're closer to the average in terms of spending. And this is an area where we have clearly seen some changes. If you go back to the detailed numbers from the 2006-2007 period, we would be consistently dead last in defense procurement per capita. So, and that's, you know, that was a big factor for some of these states, like California, for example. In terms of shifts in federal spending, the biggest shift, of course, that you're well aware of has been toward health care. And we are one of the bigger beneficiaries on a per capita basis in federal health care spending. And I know the Ways and Means folks have talked about that a lot. Part of it has to do with our own policies. We have received a large amount of federal revenue through the healthcare sector. So if you put those two together, we are around the national average in terms of that balance of payments. If we lose that SALT deduction, that would tend to shift us below average by losing that, and particularly if those, depending on if there's reductions on the spending side, that of course could affect it too. So that's what I have in terms of kind of some general background. And Chris has been working through some of the specifics that we know. And again, I'll just say it again, that very much in flux. But we're starting to get some pieces together. And Chris has got a summary for you.
I should say, colleagues, that one of the reasons for going through this process today is to give you some sense as to how these pieces fit together. Because if the federal government passes a tax bill between now and the middle of February, we may not have very much time to respond to it. And we have first decided whether we want to respond to it in some way, and then if we do, what that response would be in order to protect our own budget and our own taxpayers. So the more we understand what the mechanism is, the faster we'll be able to get on with the conversation if we have to have it.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue Office. So in terms of trying to get a handle on what's going on at the federal level, things are moving very quickly, and the two chambers aren't necessarily, they're not in lockstep. They're not entirely different, but they're not in lockstep. So trying to get a sense of what we're paying attention for. So what I have here, it's just basically a two-pager to give you a sense of the issues that we're looking at, kind of a high level. These are the things that are on our radar screen. And the way the federal bills, at least the House bill is broken out, and the Senate is similar, they have kind of four policy areas. So I decided to follow that approach. And the first one are individuals. And these are where we have the tax rates and deductions and all of those changes going on. Those are the ones that would affect directly the personal income tax. And the big question here for the impact on Oregon is, to what extent do those federal changes affect the tax base? Because if the tax base is broadened or reduced, those have a direct effect on Oregon, and I'll get to that in a second, versus some of the indirect effect. The direct effects are a magnitude larger. The second area are business reforms. And here we get into the impact on Oregon, trying to tease out the entity types that are affected, basically C corporations or non-C corps, because then that will flow through to Oregon for our corporate tax collection or the personal income tax collection, the non-corporate. And so getting at that tax base, the indirect effects there as well. And the third area is international taxation, and these are largely changes that will affect corporations, but then the question is, to what extent are the corporations that are affected, what kind of footprint do they have in Oregon, and how much of that impact might affect Oregon revenues. And the last one is exempt organizations, and this has to do with the unrelated business income tax. And those magnitudes aren't very large, but I just put it on here in trying to keep track of all of the areas. So as a review, the language we're talking about are the direct impacts and the indirect impacts. And so as already, to build onto the discussion that you've already been having, a direct impact is when income that the Fed's tax is either increased or decreased, and we are tied to that, then our income that we tax is either increased or decreased. So the example, the deductions that were talked about, if those deductions are repealed, that broadens the tax base, and we tie to those, so then the Oregon tax base broadens, and those impacts affect us directly. The indirect effects are basically through the federal tax subtraction. So right now, under current law, Oregonians are allowed to subtract against their Oregon taxes federal taxes up to about $6,500. And so an indirect effect is it when a federal tax liability changes. Say federal taxes go up by $100, then that federal tax subtraction can go up by $100, and then Oregon taxable income falls by $100. And then using a 9% rate, that means Oregon taxes would fall by 9%. So just to kind of get that clear, a direct impact, if the tax base, the federal tax base increases by $100, and then the Oregon tax base increases by $100, and then that directly affects that amount of tax. So again, sticking with a high level here, the policies on the individual tax reform, I've listed kind of an order of magnitude here. These are largely driven from the House side, where we have the repeal of the medical expense deduction and the repeal of the property taxes. So we've already talked about the SALT a little bit. The medical expenses is eliminated under the House bill. And so those two are the itemized deductions that would be repealed. Or the property tax one on the House side is actually capped at $10,000. The next four items, you have student loan interest, tuition expenses, moving expenses, and classroom expenses. These are all referred to as above-the-line deductions. So these are deductions that everybody gets to take, and we are tied to those. So if those deductions go away, then that directly affects our tax base. And so what the signs over here indicate for the direct impacts, the repeal of these deductions will increase federal taxes, and then will also increase Oregon taxes. And so that's kind of the mechanism that's at play. As an example of some of the complication that's embedded in here is alimony income and deduction is taken out of the system. So if somebody receives alimony income, that's taxable income. So the spouse that receives, or the person who receives it, that's taxable income. And then the person who pays it, they get a deduction for that. So both of those are taken away in at least one version of the House bill. So the net effect of that turns out to be to increase federal taxes, and then it would also increase Oregon taxes. And then the last item we have here is itemized deduction limitation at the federal level. This is known as the PEAS limitation. When itemized deductions are for the highest income taxpayers, the amount of itemized deductions get phased down, they get reduced. That's that limitation. So one aspect of the House bill is that that limitation goes away. So it basically increases the itemized deductions. And not all deductions are subject to that limitation. Basically, the medical is not, and casualty and some investment interest income are not subject to that. So you have both of those at play. On the repeal of that limitation increases the deduction, but then the repeal of medical expenses and property taxes reduces that. So those are the major ones that we're watching to see how they land between the two chambers. And on the indirect impact policies, the feds and the House, they repeal the personal exemption. So that broadens the tax base. So federal taxes will go up, but we're not tied to that. So the only effect on us is through the federal tax subtraction. So federal taxes go up, then the federal tax subtraction goes up, and then Oregon revenue goes down. So the key thing here is for the direct, the sign is the same, and for the indirect, the sign is the opposite. So that's one way to keep track of that. So similarly, the state deduction would be doubled at the federal level. So that's a reduction in federal taxes, and it would have an indirect increase on Oregon taxes. And then the rates in the brackets also are reduced at the federal level. So then that could have an increase in Oregon taxes. I list the income taxes here because, as Paul mentioned, we're not tied to that. So the only effect of the repeal of the income piece of the SALT would be the indirect, because the taxpayers would see an increase in their federal taxes, and the only impact on Oregon would be indirect. And then the tax credits also. They changed the family to the child tax credit. So that's one that will also affect us through the indirect. Oftentimes, the indirect effects aren't nearly as large. They're only about 10% of the direct effects. But when the order of magnitude of change that we're talking about at the federal level, we start to see impacts in Oregon that could be $10 or $20 million per provision. So that's just a landscape of the provisions we're looking at and the direction of impact. So there's always an interest in numbers. So I've taken a shot at modeling the individual provisions and getting a sense of what that does to these three metrics. So this is still very...
excuse me.
Can I ask a quick question?
Smith.
Sure.
Can we go back to the previous slide? How do we model off of that when right now all we have is quantitative, not qualitative analysis? So we don't know what the percentage of each of those are going to be yet, or a numerical number with it. We just know that right now it may increase or it may decrease.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Smith, we have one of our primary tools for the personal income taxes. We have a tax calculator based on a sample of tax returns. So we actually have real data, if you will. I mean, it's all a sample, and it's a statistical sample. So we have a sense for how much is claimed in medical expenses. And we have that projected out over 10 years. That's tied, without rabbit trailing too far into our tools, that is tied to the economic forecast that you hear every quarter. You're going to hear that in a couple weeks. So we have all of that forecast, and we have a sample year for all of the taxpayers in Oregon. We know what income levels they are and the kinds of deductions that they use. So basically, we can go into this tool and model the amount of tax liability, federal tax liability, all the pieces of it. I mean, it's based on a sample, so they're projections. But that gives us an idea of what that revenue impact would be of any one of the provisions. And the tool is limited to items that we have data for. So in that sense, it doesn't cover all aspects of the tax code.
And so just a quick follow-up.
Mm-hmm, please.
So within that model then, let's take moving expenses where we see that there perhaps could be an increase in the tax change both on federal and state. Within that model, do you assign it a percentage? Do you assign it a number?
Each.
Because do we know what the federal action is going to be yet?
No. Well, in this case, what we're working here would be a repeal of it. So they could change it somehow. I mean, there could be an infinite number of changes.
You're going with a total repeal.
It would be, right. Most of these are full repeal. The one exception is the property tax, where that's limited to $10,000.
$10,000. Okay. Thank you.
So one one starting point we have here is the tax expenditure report produced by the Department of Revenue. So that gives us, okay, ballpark, are we talking $10 million, $50 million, $100 million okay. for a given provision? Okay. And then we can model that.
Thank you. I now understand. Thank you.
But that ties in directly with where this chart comes from, and this is output from this model, where we have the projection over the next 10 years. And so for these individual provisions, so I basically plugged in the alternate federal tax rates and the repeal of the various deductions, the repeal of the personal exemption, basically turn those on or turn them off, however, and then run the model, and then I get a difference in what the projected liability would be versus the current law. And so the starting point here is, because we're talking about federal provisions, the reduction in federal taxes paid by Oregonians is about $1.2 billion over each year. And so the trends here are largely built off the current law revenue forecast. This jump right here deals with some of the sunsets that are in the federal provision. Some of these tax cuts apply for 5 years and then they go away. So when they go away, the federal tax reduction falls from about $1.2 billion to $1.1. So when federal taxes fall by about $1.2 billion, that translates into the federal tax subtraction falling by about $600 million. It's not one-to-one because it is limited. So if you have a person right now whose taxes are federal taxes are $10,000 a year, and then they fall to $7,000 a year, they do experience that reduction in federal taxes, but there's no change to their federal tax subtraction based on that. So that's why there's not a one-to-one relationship between the federal tax subtraction and federal taxes. And then this green line is the bottom line estimated impact on Oregon revenues, which is about $150 million a year. So all of this thrown into the pot all at once, the bottom line impact is about $150 million a year increase in Oregon taxes. Now, that's very specific to what I input to the model, and where I can't emphasize enough how dynamic things are at the federal level. Mm. So this is really just a first shot at the order of magnitude that we're looking at. And so it's important for the community to keep this in mind as you're keeping track of decisions that you may have to make in the near future. And most of that $150 million, you have the direct impact. So the largest impact there, for example, is the repeal of the medical expense deduction. That goes away. That directly affects the Oregon tax base. We get a lot of revenue from that. And so that's just meant to be an order of magnitude kind of picture. Now, comparing the House and Senate versions, here are half a dozen particular items that are different between the House and the Senate versions. So I mentioned the repeal of the medical deduction. That would raise about $65 million a year in Oregon. But that's not in the Senate version. That's left alone, so there's no impact there. The limit on the property tax deduction to $10,000. So the next two items are property tax provisions. Limiting the property tax deduction to $10,000 would raise about $16 million here. And that's purely the indirect effect. The property tax is capped at $10,000. So if somebody has property taxes of $12,000, their deduction would be reduced to $10,000. So they lose $2,000 in deduction, and their federal taxes go up. The federal tax suppression goes up and then goes down, and then Oregon taxes go up. So that's an indirect. The repeal of the property tax deduction, which is not in the House version, it's in the Senate version, that's about $250 million a year. If that's just taken away completely.
A year, okay.
The educator expense, that's fairly minimal given the numbers we're talking about, but it's one that people can relate to. And then the student loan interest deduction. This is one that's on the order of $20 million. That one is also a direct, that's an above the line deduction. So that deduction goes away, the federal tax base broadens, and the Oregon tax base broadens, and so we get about $20 million a year. Then the incomplete row here, the pass-through rate. I don't have numbers on this one for right now, but I wanted to include it because of how the two different chambers are treating it differently. In the House, they're treating it as a rate, a 25% rate on certain pass-through income. On the Senate side, they're treating it as a deduction. So if the change, the tax rate changes, that won't have a direct impact on Oregon. It'll just be the indirect effect. However, if there's a deduction of income, then we would likely tie to that directly, and it could have a larger impact on Oregon. And this is one that we're following closely, and it's going to circle back to a presentation later today. The rate here applies to passive income. It's not to active income. So the feds are looking at these pass-through entities and separating out the S-corps and the partnerships and looking at that income and looking at some of it as business income from small business owners and some of it as investment income. And so the 25% rate is on the passive income, the argument apparently being that that's really an investment income. So having a 25% tax rate on the passive income brings it more in line with the capital gains and dividend tax rate at the federal level, which is about 20%. But this is one that it really depends on which direction the feds go. Assuming something gets passed, it really depends on how they do that as to what the impact on Oregon would be. And then the last couple things here, I just have bullet points. We're just getting into these pieces. The business tax reforms, we have our old friends, bonus depreciation and Section 179 expensing. Those are back into play. The bonus, they would be extended. The bonus depreciation would go up to 100% for 5 years. The Section 179 expensing would also be expanded, although to different extents in the House version or the Senate version. So we'll be looking at that to figure out what the impact is on Oregon. You have accounting methods. There's an expansion of cash accounting for small businesses that would have likely a negative impact. There's a net interest deduction. Items D and E are revenue raisers at the federal level. There's a limitation on a net interest deduction, and then there's a limitation on like-kind exchanges. So that to the extent that we're tied to those, that may be a tax increase, and so some of those may offset. Right now, these are on our radar screen to follow carefully. And then item three, on international taxation, I just put two items here. There's apparently a new deduction for foreign source dividends. I need to figure out how that might affect us. It's a new deduction, so I'm not sure exactly how that would affect us. Item B is the income repatriation, and that could be very big or very small, depending on the companies that get affected. These are the companies that are holding profits overseas, and they could get it's a 5 or 10 or 12% tax rate on it at the federal level if they bring it back to Oregon. Now, that may or may not have an impact on us in two ways. One, it would depend on the companies that really have it and whether or not they have a presence in Oregon and are paying Oregon income tax. And two, the mechanics of how the feds do that. If they do it in such a way that it affects taxable income, then we would probably have a direct effect to that since we tie directly to taxable income. If they do it in some other mechanism where they just say, you bring back the income and we'll tax you 12% and then that's that, then that likely would not have an impact on Oregon. So this is another one where the details matter. And the repatriation was done before, back in 2004, and there's debate about how effective that was. So we do have some experience on that policy. And then the last are the exempt organizations. It has to do with the unrelated business income tax. And I'm just trying to keep track of everything that's on there. There weren't any major revenue provisions on that in terms of the order of magnitudes that we're talking about.
We've touched on the income repatriation issue before when we talked about tax havens.
Correct.
I mean, that's only a portion of it, obviously, but the mechanisms involved there are very similar to what you're talking about, aren't they?
They could be.
Maybe.
Yeah, maybe. Right. That's what we're
doing. And it all depends on whether income repatriation is done in a way that changes the definition of income or doesn't. I think that's what you've just said, but I'm not sure.
Possibly. Rather than a definition of income, I think of it more as a location of those profits. So they're sitting overseas somewhere. If they bring it back to the U.S., under current law, if they bring it back to the U.S., they get taxed at the 35%.
Right.
So the provision is basically, if you bring it back during this time period, we'll only tax it at 12%, something along those lines. And so if it's done that way, then it may not even touch the regular corporate tax system.
Right.
So then maybe no effect on Oregon. if they do it in such a way that you bring back the income and it gets added to taxable income on the tax return, then it would flow through.
Right. That's what I was trying to say when I talked about the definition of income.
Yes.
But okay. Yeah. Got it. All right. Questions on this section? If we get to the point where we're faced with a specific legislation, I'm sure we'll get into a lot more detail, won't we?
Yes, this is just meant to be a high level.
Yeah. Okay. Representative Vance, please.
So the 1031 repeal, is that in both the House and the Senate proposal?
I know it's in the House. I'm not sure if it's in the Senate. And I believe it eliminates the like-kind exchange for everything except real property. I think that's the provision in the House. I have to be careful. I go back and forth between the two.
Follow up.
Yes, please.
Do we have any idea the volume of those exchanges in this state?
I don't think we do. I haven't been able to locate such information. So it's on the list. It's one of the things I'm working through to get better information on. But at this point, I don't have solid information on how much of that activity occurs here. I mean, that should exist somewhere, but I have yet to put my fingers on it.
Thank you.
Okay. Next piece, huh? Yeah. Oh, we're on to the next item. Transient lodging tax revenue. I pulled it up without realizing we'd actually moved on to the next piece. Transient lodging tax revenue trends and issues.
Afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Mazen Malik with Legislative Revenue Office. And a less salty tax note. We'd have so the transient lodging tax is the issue that we thought will refresh your memory for maybe issues to be taken care of in the coming or time to come in the session, either the short or the long session. But quickly, I need to get back to some history of how this process came. The birth of the transient lodging tax on the state level was in House Bill 2267. That's in the 2003 session. Now, that did a lot of things and took a lot of time to do. I was looking at the history of the House Bill 2267, and it has passed the House floor on August 22nd. And passed the Senate floor on August 23rd. The 2003 session was probably the longest session in history, my first session, and Chair Barnhart and Representative Gig Smith, probably the only ones in the committee that would remember that how pleasant that session was.
Well, and as luck would have it, I was on the Revenue Committee that year.
Yes.
Yes, one of the reasons why the session ran long is because some of us, including Representative Williams and I, disagreed with where they were going on this particular bill.
Yes. So this particular bill had some of the, or you know, got some of the scars of those discussions. One of the issues that were contentious at the time is to have the local transient lodging tax and how we deal with it. And the issue came as to have a moratorium on that, and that moratorium works in the idea of what is to be done new. Now, the tourism, the tax would be 1% on consideration rendered, and it used for very particular purposes and tourism promotion. Now, after the moratorium on the local taxes said if you use it or if you have local tax, then you would continue spending the same amount of money and percentages that you used to spend on tourism. You don't reduce that. But, of course, no there was not very clear of how that would work exactly and how we can estimate that, especially that if you need to increase new tax, you would have to have 70% spent on tourism and 30% you could use it as you wish. So those difficulties have always been an issue that kind of had that time of House Bill 2267. Now, of course, the second time, just like every bill that we have, House Bill 2267, 2003 was a bill, and just the session after that, and at that time we used to have all biennial sessions, odd number of years, it needed some fixing. So we got it on 2197, also in the Revenue Committee, and we fixed some of the definitions of what applies and what does not apply. So it in the House Bill, 2005, we defined what actually is the things that are the base for that tax. And make it very precise on these definitions. Then they're given some exemptions, and the exemptions on certain facilities, those are the healthcare facilities and the nonprofits, the emergency use shelters, and so on, and the exemptions on persons such as the federal employees and official business. And then something needed to be clarified later on in time. I think we tried this clarification in the session 2012, where this new model was coming through of the internet providers and so on. And those did not at that time feel that they are defined under the definitions that we have. But according to all the work we've done, the definitions that we thought are in law are already inclusive of all these that have emerged with new models. But the House Bill 2656 came to clarify these issues, that the transient lodging intermediaries are also included in the definitions of the transient lodging tax, and they should be also collecting. So that basically clarified that the providers are not the only ones that they do it, but also the tax, the transient lodging tax collector include the intermediaries, which are the internet providers and so on. So, and that is something that is the definition for the state transient lodging tax as well as the locals. The second thing that was important in Senate Bill 2656 that previously was not clear was a clarification of what is the base of the tax. So in the past, it would used to be you have a room rent, if you will, and then the internet provider or the OTCs will pay on the lower price that they get the wholesale price on. So that's one thing. So the bill said, actually, the way we have it in law is it is based on the retail price for the consumer, the ultimate price that the consumer pays, and not any other wholesale price. Not only that, but that price is also inclusive of services that are given as part of the room service, meaning if you have cleaning fees, if you have resort fees, if you have any other these additional fees that you pay to a hotel or motel or so on, those are included in the base of what you estimate the tax on. Mm-hmm. So that was a big clarification for the tax and how we do with it. Then in 2016, also came through the Revenue Committee, of course. It was the increase in the rate from 1% to 1.8, and that to start in July 1st, 2016, go to 2020, what it comes down to 1.5. The intent of that was to fund the certain events that will happen in that time. Also, the House Bill 4146 changed the distribution of the revenues. In the past, it was something for the regional tourism to be up to a certain amount, a ceiling of 15%. This bill 4146 actually said 32% will go to regional in two categories. One is in regional development, and 10% will go through grants. And it also asked us to do asked LRO to do a study group of how what the difficulties and issues of that. I included the study group report in all this for your reference in case you wanted to have more information on that. And these are the distribution changes. 65% go to the programs. And the other main thing that happened in 4146 is we, the word marketing and the emphasis on marketing as the tourism expenditure was taken out. So the activities of tourism became a lot more inclusive, a bigger category to be considered. So the regional allocation, also formula distribution, and how the commission works with that. And the commission has established seven regions. And here is important to bring out that the regions, the tourism regions that defined by the Oregon Tourism Commission, is slightly different than the tax regions that we collect from, that they are about 10 taxes, and I'll show you a map of that soon. But the general program and administration of this, as we talk to the Department of Revenue, this is how we look at it. This started in January 1st, 2000. Not 20,000, 2004 or 2004. You have about 3,300 or a little more than that of payers, and annual tax revenue used to be about 7.8 million. The fiscal year 16, or I'm sorry, calendar year 16 came at 21 million. Remember, this includes only half a year of increase of the tax. Starting in July. So the idea also was that there's quarterly reporting required. However, the quarterly reporting is for the reports and the forms that are sent to the Department of Revenue. The payment of the tax should be on a monthly basis as it is collected. And the collecting agents owners, providers, or in this instance, the intermediaries, get to keep 5% of the tax for their collection efforts. So we have the regions. These are the tax collection regions as known by the tax regions, 10 of them.
Representative Smith Warren.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mawson, thank you. I just want to clarify again. So these are the regions in which the taxes are collected, but the distribution regions are a different set of regions.
Yes. There are seven regions. A couple of these are put together to make it, because, you know, there is the regional organizations seem to be more efficient and effective in doing so.
Well,
yeah, please.
And to confirm then, so there, does that add to the administrative costs that you have to take? You have to figure out how much came out of each region and then rejigger the numbers to figure out how it gets distributed?
Not really.
Not
because
significantly?
Those are, you know, the borders and where they come are slightly elementary.
Okay. Thank you.
So to take a look at the lodging tax receipts in general. This is how it has been going since the year 2004. It's been solidly going up with, you know, a few exceptions that where you have your income, taxable income going down, which corresponds to economic slowdown. And you have the tax also going down because, you know, these taxes seem to be affected by the economic cycle. So the receipts by region, here you would see how that increases and where most of the receipts are. And you could see most of the receipts are, primarily coming from this area, the Portland Metro, and then the Willamette Valley, North Coast. And some here don't necessarily change much towards the end. Now, if you look at those numbers as shares of how the total is, you would find that the Portland Metro area is about 40% of what brings in, started it, or at this time, and it keeps going up. There's more and more coming from the Portland area. Willamette Valley and the Central are probably the ones that also keep going up slightly less, but they are taking more market share, if you will. While you see that these areas are actually losing in their contribution of where the receipts are coming from. So, if you keep this in mind, a few slides down the line, you'll see how big the impact on areas like the North Coast and the Southern Coast and all the coastal areas in Central Oregon where a lot of the concentration in tourism seem to have a big impact on that region.
Okay, so the central here, that's the one you call 7, isn't it, in the map?
Yes.
Okay. So everything else in the state except Portland, the valley, and the Bend area is down slightly.
Well, it is not down. It's,
maybe not southern.
It's the share of how much it contributes to the total is
Thank
down.
You. Yes.
So the Portland area is getting more and more of the total. It's paying more and more of the big pie, of the pie, basically.
Got it. Yeah, so I actually compared two charts, don't I? The blue one and the and the red-orange one.
Yes.
Okay, thanks.
So the one thing also is important in looking at analyzing these pictures is where the money is coming from, who's paying. And obviously, hotels have always been the lion's share of the establishment or the facilities that pay. Hotels and motels, and that's why it's known as the hotel motel tax kind of thing. Now, vacation homes have started and been for a while gaining share, and then you have these intermediaries. You could see how they're climbing up. Now, remember, this is only 2014 and 2015 and not 2016, while the other ones had 2016 in them. And the reason is these seem to be an issue we have with the change that is happening with the system, Department of Revenue. There is no loss necessarily of information. But we're moving from one system to a new one with all the old system and its problems and how the legacy systems work. But we had it for 40-some years, and we knew the old guy very well. And we could get stuff from it a lot more confidently. Now things are changing. We know we have the information, but we're still not necessarily sure how we're going to be able to sort it out. So, but we were able to get at least, because it's important for us to get the intermediaries and see how they are contributing and how this new economy of the internet is changing and who's paying. We know in 2015 they paid about 1.4 million, while in 2016 they paid 3.3 million. This is about 100 and 31% increase. Of course, that might be slightly pushed up because of the 6 months change in rate, but you could see how this new model of promoting hotels, motels, and transient lodging is shifting towards that internet economy, if you will. Mm-hmm. So other issues that you would have, I've polled both the Department of Revenue and others and see what kind of things that we still find problems with. And it is enforcement issues still. There are a lot of work that was done on enforcement issues, but there is still issues with auditing and how the locals and DOR kind of be able to put things together and what might help. Then the one of the recommendations that the work group came out with is trying to find or encourage a path or a way for the Department of Revenue to be the collecting arm of locals. Now that is probably still being worked and unfolded. It has not necessarily had it's going to take a while to figure it out, but once these things are happening, you have an improved collection efficiency, if you will, and less costs for the locals. Some of the challenges you have: frequent changes in ownership, especially in vacation homes and that kind of ownership. Lack of awareness that there are two taxes of, lodging tax on the state level and on the local level. There are multiple owners of single facilities. Those are the, who's liable for what and who should be paying. These issues might or might not have an easy solution. Difficulty in determining the tax collections. And, of course, with state agencies, you always have to say that they're not funding it well. So the collection versus the tax payment. Also here, these are one of the issues we've talked about. That when people collect, or providers, they need to submit monthly. Remember, the Department of Revenue actually sends to the Commission on monthly payments, while they get quarterly reports. Mm. So these quarterly reports, some people, or some individuals or companies, think of them as the time of payment, also quarterly rather than monthly payments. So with a change in the tax, Department of Revenue kind of noticed this issue and noticed that we need to have a lot more education on this. So. And then, there is the multi-state issues and the nexus.
Excuse me, are there penalties for late payment?
I think there is penalties for late payments. Yes.
So if you pay quarterly, one assumes you owe a late payment for the other 2 months.
The discussion, I think, the difficulty with it is when people collect for payment, and then they wait until actual transaction occurs. So you might want to go to vacation in July, and you do your reservation in January. You paid in January, and you don't actually consume until July. Or these kind of issues, some of it are more nuanced than others, but the payments do have actual penalties.
Well, I suppose it may depend on whether you have consumed the service in January because it's not refundable, or whether you don't consume it until July because it is.
Well, that's when.
That's one argument.
Right. When you consume it in July, you cannot refund it. You have to pay it. But
Representative Marsh is listening carefully.
Still the idea: if you collect the tax, you need to.
You should remit
the tax.
Then. Thank you. Yeah. And does our statute make that clear?
I think at least we have the idea that these kind of things need to be clarified, or either we will discuss it with Department of Revenue, see if we need a legislative solution, or is it something that, that is that could be done in education of the consumer and so on. So if we do, we probably, with the Department of Revenue, bring it as a committee bill to look at.
Could this be done through an authorization for rulemaking?
I think the Department of Revenue has the authority to make
these rules. Okay, so they may already have the authority to make a rule that says if you've collected it, you must pay it within 30 days.
Yes, I think that that is already there. It is probably how it is understood by the people who actually collect.
All right. The reason I'm asking all these questions is there's a possibility we may end up with a bill involving this area of actually collecting the taxes that are due, and we ought to put in that bill whatever technical things we need in order to make sure that that the money is actually collected.
Yes. So one of the last things that we have, and I'm going to expand on this a little bit, is a problem that we talked about for a while, which is the affordable housing issues and their shortages in the tourist areas. The economic solutions, economic issues on that. And just to give an idea and show, these are the housing units used, and these are the vacant seasonal, recreational, occasional use. So if you see in the area here, you'll find mostly of it is about, you know, 6%, around 6% if you exclude what's labeled as Central Oregon, about 6% of vacancies that are done in seasonal recreational use. While in the Central Oregon, you have 11.5%. If you look at the northern coast area, you're looking about 25.8%. That's almost 26%.
Okay.
So you see where the areas that are concentrating on these properties to be part of the recreational and occasional use, part of a tourism-driven industry, if you will. That is not the case, of course, in the Portland area. It's only 0.9%. But remember, the Portland area brings the biggest amount of money for the tax, and you know, same thing with the Willamette Valley, 1.2. It brings the second largest amount. Mm-hmm. So
there are a lot more housing units. So, in terms of its effect on the availability of housing for local workers, it appears to me as though it's likely to have the most effect on the North Coast, but also a very significant effect east of the Cascade Summit.
Right, and especially in the Central Oregon region, where it's about 11.5%. So, but if you look at it, of the, you know, the taxable lodging tax.
Is there a question down here?
Oh, I was just going to make a comment.
Please
Thank
go.
You.
Please do.
I think even when those numbers are smaller, you look at Southern Oregon, it's 1.8%, but we have vacancy rates of, you know, 1 to 2%. So this is it's actually an enormous impact on the housing supply.
Yeah,
that is correct. And if you look at different measures in order to see how these things interact with this market, if you look at the taxable lodging sales, so these are the sales of taxable transactions of lodging, and you take them by per capita, you see how the North Coast has the largest number for, so that's about almost more than $2,000 per capita for, which corresponds to the idea of 28% of all the units are open because of the amounts of the tourism and industry that is based on or in that region and for that, while your statewide is less than 500. Then the employment, of course, by region, that also is reflective of how these things work. You look at 26% that employment of a share of all employment of, in the North Coast is in tourism employment. And that keeps going down. You know, the central also, the same idea that we saw with the vacancies, the Rogue Valley, the Columbia Gorge, while statewide it's only 13%. So twice as much in the North Coast as it is in statewide. Now, if you even sift out those effects even more and
excuse me just a moment, and that employment is seasonal primarily, isn't it?
Well, that employment, yes, will be seasonal.
So the 26% of the total employment in the North Coast is related to travel and tourism.
Right.
And that's seasonal. So I'm guessing that that means that a very significant portion of people who have jobs during a year are also unemployed during another part of the year.
And that is correct, Mr. Chair.
Or they move to a different part of the state for part
of the year. There is some of that, too. That is the movement of labor. Although labor is not as mobile as capital, but there is still a mobility of that sense.
Thank you. We're talking about this tax, but I think I'm learning at least about the economy of the state, too,
sure,
while we're doing this.
There are obviously few regions that are very dependent on this industry. So these are way above average. This is the state average, and these are all within that. So if you take out the Portland Metro and Willamette Valley and look at how big the geographic footprint of these regional jobs, so you have travel and tourism is as big as government sector in these areas, and then that's followed by healthcare. Total employment is about, and it's even bigger than construction, manufacturing, and so on.
Tell us what these percentage numbers mean.
So,
is this the percent of the whole state, or is it something else?
It is. It's percentage. So these 28% of all jobs outside the Portland metro area would be in tourism and travel.
Okay.
And the same thing in government. So it is as big as the government sector.
So what does total employment mean? That was the thing that got me, was confusing to me.
So the total employment will be the total employment numbers for the state. Take out Portland Metro.
Okay. So we're using a different base.
Right. This is in order to isolate how much this regional impact is.
So the employment in this area, outside of Portland, outside of the Willamette Valley, is 24% of the total employment in the state. Yes?
Yeah.
That's the gray line. And of that, 28% is travel and tourism. Have I understood that correctly?
So,
it looks like you're using two different denominators here. I just want to make it clear. Sorry, I understood them.
Yes, I think that is absolutely correct.
Thank you.
Yes.
Except,
yeah. Excuse me.
Looks like you're going to get more than 100% though, if you add up.
Well, three quarters of the jobs are in the Willamette Valley and in Portland.
Right.
And of the quarter that's left, 28%. Are in tourism and travel. 28% are in government, and okay, you might end up with more than 100%. You're right. Yeah. Let's see, that's 50, 60, 70.
Well, some
89. You know, right. So there's some people have jobs in more than one industry.
Exactly. So the industries, now remember a lot of this is and this construction. These jobs are not necessarily what they call, they have an element of the nomadic movement in it.
Right.
They move around and they have different.
Right. Well, if I'm piecing together an income and I work in tourism and travel in the summertime, I might work in one of these other places.
Something
in the
different, right.
In
or
the
you
winter.
Might.
Okay.
So, but there is one thing to remember about all these things is what so-called work productivity. Remember that manufacturing has the highest work productivity. This is the value added in adding, you know, per dollars for the gross state product. You know, the total private is about 90,000. Travel and tourism has a very low value added type of jobs, and in the same time, low income in the same. So although the impact is large, it is not the highly paid jobs that you might think, you know, and that, you know, explains some of these difficulties that we have with these. But to remember the spending on lodging, this age group, the 55 to 64, seem to spend the most out of on, and that makes sense, of course.
Representative Bent's place.
You know, if you go back to that slide, one just previous to this one, I think, your productivity slide.
Oh,
the blue one.
Here it is.
Yeah. That really does illustrate, doesn't it, the you don't really get ahead much when you trade in egg, or I don't know where timber fits on this, for tourism.
Yeah.
You're not moving not the yet. Needle.
No.
Not in the productivity. No, actually, you'll be losing in that on the scale of the high-paying jobs and so on. So, yes, you might have more jobs because you need a lot more to do a certain facility. But the value added and the wages are not comparable.
Follow up.
Yeah, please.
Right. Of course, the whole concept here under this transit lodging tax is to increase tourism, and I'm going to ask why, if this money is being well spent. I guess that's the question, isn't it? I mean, if, at least with egg, you've got a chance of being able to take that potato and make it into a value added something. I'm not sure what we're getting out of egg and out of travel to it.
Chair Barnhart and Vice Chair Benz, I will be happy to look into these a little more intently, if you'd look. I mean, these issues have to do with economic development, with things of what are the choices that the government makes, and the private sector makes, and investment type of where do we go, what do we do, and, you know, the movement of capital and labor and so on. So I'm not sure that the transient lodging tax and the promotion of tourism was meant as an exchange for the loss of jobs in manufacturing or in timber. But it was thought of maybe, at least from what I recall at the time, that what it was built is in order to push and have economic kind of new engine called tourism, not necessarily in replacement of, but in addition. Now, if we happen to, during the time and during the way, lost one sector of the economy, we lost one of the more productive sectors on these regions, or in that one region versus the other. The other ones not necessarily are enough to compensate.
That's a good point. Representative
Benz. I just want to mention that there was an attempt to establish a 2.5 million acre monument down in one that was one third of one of my counties. And the argument was that there would be vast numbers of tourists, incredibly, you know, helping our economy. And looking at these numbers here, I would go, not so much. So, I mean, if the trade-off was to lose jobs that might have paid three or four times that, which in fact was the case. But these numbers are really very interesting. There's another point, Mr. Chair, that this does bring up, and it's that, the transient lodging tax, we take that money from people who are transients, right? That's why.
That's correct.
And so we have determined that it's, for whatever reason, a good idea to reinvest that in more lodging, more trying to attract more of this type of business.
Or tourism.
But there's nothing that would have prevented us from saying, gee, maybe we ought to be putting that money into something that is more productive. Now, that politically would be extremely difficult, but still, I was just wondering about the linkage between this tax and focusing it back on this, that, which is apparently not generating much of a return.
We did have that conversation.
That's just an aside.
Well, you know, Mr. Chair and Mr. Vice Chair, there are places where, and this tax is not necessarily the only way it should be spent, if you will. Local governments, for an example, collect something in the neighborhood of about $150 million a year in transient lodging taxes, and they spend it on general type of services that they do. So this is about 20-some million that the state collects, and the whole arrangement of it was to be spent on tourism. Now, is that some of the difficulties that always existed is about who is allowed to add new taxes on transient lodging. And everybody loves transient lodging taxes because you're taxing the French, basically, right? And whoever comes in, they're not. So that's how it is conceived, because it's an export tax, if you will. You know, you're being paid by somebody else. So, but the 1.5, which is 20 some million dollars, are chosen as this policy of the state so far is to be collected by the Department of Revenue, and it goes to the Oregon Tourism Commission, that is a semi-autonomous agency that actually doesn't have the budget process going through the legislature, and doing tourism promotion type of activities in order to make that sector as the policy goes.
Representative Marsh?
I would suggest there are additional tourism benefits that really aren't calculated here in terms of, when I look at my own community, the ability of tourists to support development of restaurants, cultural facilities, other kinds of activities that are central to the community and that draw people in, that fuel real estate prices, that have all kinds of other impacts on the quality of life that we're able to provide for residents, because we have a constant flow of tourism dollars coming in to provide the base supports for those things. So I think there's a broad benefit to tourism for some communities that may not be reflected in these numbers.
Senator Marsh, yes, I'm sure that the data is trying to find a picture that makes it more intelligible to what the impacts are and how we can look at it and deal with it. There is no one set of data that will be able to answer all the questions or give all the answers to the difficulties.
Comment?
Well, yeah, please. Yeah.
And nor was I expecting that from you at all. It was just more of a response to Rep. Bent's, because it's not a direct apples and apples kind of comparison. There are other elements when you look at shifting jobs.
Yeah, he's looking at the direct impact on employment in the tourism field and not on the indirect impact of tourism in general.
Right.
One of the things I would note is that, and this is purely anecdotal, I don't have any scientifically based data, when we get the Regional Area Innovation Network reports in the Upper Willamette Valley, it is amazing the number of people, entrepreneurs, who have come to that part of the state from off, mostly from California, and they came here first to visit. They came as tourists. They came to look at the place. They came to vacation, to have a vacation, and they ended up moving their businesses here. Now, those are certainly not reflected in these numbers, and I would not claim any particular value to my anecdotal information, but it is a fact that there are side effects of being an attractive place for people to visit that also has an impact on other industries. And I'll note that the ones I'm thinking about fall into that second category of information where the returns are quite a bit higher.
And that's correct, Mr. Chair. There is no no way to capture that.
You can't capture that data, not easily anyway. Yeah.
And so, you know, finally, as I said, these are the most group of our, you know, population that seems to consume this service. And based on that, you could probably put all these different things with income. We plagiarized this from the Office of Economic Analysis as a forecast in the future for the hotel demand. And it seems like there is a growth in the future until, you know, 2024. The rate of growth slows down, but it's still steady at about 1.5% or so.
Great. Any other questions for Mazin? I would simply say that this is a wonderful report,
yeah.
And not just for the materials that clearly you were trying to get at, but also for what it tells us about the state's economy in general. And I appreciate it for that reason, in addition to the specific issue that you were asked to look at. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Can I say one thing
before we start on?
Yeah.
Now, some of you who are observers may have noticed a different person sitting in the LRO section.
Ah.
That she is our new economist, Jamie McGovern. This is Jamie's first day with us. So she will, Christine Broniak left us, and so Jamie is replacing her. Jamie has experience working with the PUC, working with the Citizens Utility Board. She's also taught economics. She's been a professor. And she received her training at Arizona State, so I think she's our first Sun Devil. So to join the LRO staff. So anyway, we're really happy to have Jamie, and you'll be seeing a lot of her come February session.
That's wonderful. Wonderful. Thank you very much for being here. We won't expect a presentation from you today.
Tomorrow.
Okay. Paul.
So, Mr. Chair, our next topic is something we have been working on grew out of a lot of the work that you did in the session around business tax reform and trying to find a path there that might work in terms of some of the state's revenue, long-term structural revenue issues. And one of the areas where we ran into, and I know that you had a lot of discussions in this committee, is kind of how do we look at proposals in terms of their impacts on the different business entity types. And that seemed to be a major issue around, for example, looking at the commercial activity tax and how it might affect different entity types. So Chris has been working in the interim with both House and Senate on trying to get a better understanding of that. And really the idea here is to provide a framework for you to continue some of that work in business tax reform. So that's our goal here, is to give you some background and a framework to look at proposals in the future.
Wonderful.
And with that, Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue Office. And so to jump right in, a lot of this is probably familiar, kind of just a review of some of these concepts, but then I do get to a couple of examples. In this presentation, for those who follow the committee, this is almost identical to something I provided in the Senate Revenue Committee a couple months ago, just a couple minor changes. So kind of resetting the discussion for the business entity types, we have four different kinds. We've got sole proprietors, partnerships, S-corps, C-corps, and LLCs. And the C-corps pay the corporation income tax, and all of the others really pay tax through the personal income tax. And when we use the term pass-through partner, generally that means partnerships and S-corporations. I have seen some people include sole proprietors in that, but generally it's just the partnership and S-corp, because the distinction there from a tax perspective is, for a sole proprietor, is that there is no distinction between the person and the business. However, for all of the other kinds, there is that distinction. So the partnerships and S-corps, the income passes through, if you will, to the individual partners or shareholders. And the LLCs, while I think you've heard me say this before, they're not in federal law. They choose which form they're going to file taxes as. And for the most part, this is their partnerships, but provide some data on that. So just a quick slide on the context of why this is relevant. Here we have U.S. business receipts from 1980 through 2012, and the landscape has changed dramatically over the years. And two key inflection points, if you will, and the Tax Reform Act of 1986. Up until that point, the business receipts were really dominated by C corporations. But with the federal tax reform in 1986, we see that S corps really started to take over, and that had to do with the change in the federal tax rates. And then around 1990, LLCs really started to take hold. They had been in place, I think it was Wyoming that had the first LLC law back in maybe 1977. But around the 90s is when they really started to take off. And so now if we fast forward to 2012, we can really see that the share of business receipts attributable to pass-through entities has really grown. And so this is really the backdrop for why this is a relevant topic for discussion in taxation. So jumping into the data that we have on who these entities are and so forth, we have the number of businesses in Oregon, if you will, is about 427,000, and 278,000 of them are self-employed. These will be primarily your Schedule C filers, and then about 149,000 that are of an other form. So the sole proprietors, in terms of number of businesses, dominate the landscape. About 65% of the businesses are these sole profs. About 7% of them are the C corporations, and then 28% are the pass-through entities. And these pass-through entities are divided pretty evenly between partnerships and S-corps, about 60,000 for each type. So looking at the business income and where that comes from, or the tax returns with business income, this is just more detail on the types of these businesses. So the sole props, there are the 278,000 of them. About 230,000 of them are the non-farm sole proprietors. These will be your kind of stereotypical small business person. They don't incorporate. They didn't establish an LLC. They just have their own thing that they do, and they file a Schedule C. About 17,000 of these sole proprietors are actually LLCs. They've established themselves as LLCs, and they've chosen to file a Schedule C. Some of the lingo for this is they get referred to as disregarded entities. And then about 30,000 of these sole proprietors are actually farm sole proprietors. And these are folks who file a Schedule F on the personal income tax return. So that's the breakdown for the sole proprietors. The pass-throughs for the roughly 120,000 of them, 61,000 are S corporations. And of the 60,000 that are partnerships, about two-thirds of those are actually LLCs. So 41,000 are LLCs and about 17,000 are actual partnerships of a general or limited variety. And then at the top we have the 29,000 C corporations. So it's just a different look of who the players are in terms of these businesses in Oregon in 20. And I should say I've used 2014 data for some pieces of information. I do have more recent data, but rather than mixing and matching tax years, I've just gone back to 2014. It doesn't dramatically change given the year, but the magical thing about 2014 is complete data. So if we switch from the number of businesses to the economy, basically Oregon sales, we have just under $318 billion in Oregon sales in 2014. And the lion's share of that are the C corporations. That's $192 billion of the $317 billion. And then bouncing down to the sole props, about $16 billion come from the sole proprietors, with the non-farm counting for most of those, the $14 billion. And then on the pass-through entities, we have about $63 billion from the S-corps, $27 billion from the LLCs, and $18 billion from the partnerships. So the dominant player there is the S-corporations, but then the LLCs are second at $27 billion.
These two graphs are almost opposite of each other, aren't they?
Correct.
The number of entities versus the amount of money generated in Oregon sales.
Right. So bouncing between the two, we have a lot of businesses that are the really small guys. And then On the other hand, we have some very large C corporations, and this was a subject of some debate last year, or in 2016. And then, so going from Oregon sales to business income, so we have about $318 billion in sales, and then all told, that gets down to about just under $18 billion of taxable business income. And this is that distribution. It changes a little bit again. The lion's share, the largest piece of that, is C corporations at just under $8 billion of taxable income. And then the pass-through entities, of their $6.3 billion, $4 billion are the S-corps, and then LLCs are only $632, and then general partnerships are $1.5. So that's another difference between sales and business income. Here, sales, if we look at LLCs, they have $27 billion in sales, and then the partnerships have $18 billion. If we get down to income, it's reversed. The partnerships have the larger share of that income. And then we get to the sole proprietors, which have just about $3.5 billion of taxable business income. And almost all of that are the non-farm. We have about $500 from LLCs, the disregarded the single-member LLCs. And then the farm...
Lost money.
And that's pretty typical every year. As a group, they lose money. There are definitely those who have income and those have lost, but when we combine them, the losses outweigh the gains.
Interesting.
In an aggregate amount.
So 14 isn't a particularly bad year for the farmers. It's
pretty typical.
If you work as a farmer, you should expect to lose money every year. Isn't that what you just said?
Pretty much. Well, when we talk about farms, because these are sole proprietor farms.
Yes.
So it's not
small
all
farm.
Farms.
Small
it's
farms.
Not all farms.
That's probably why my dad has no job.
Well, and what Representative Nose just said, exactly. Farmers have to work in town in order to pay for the farm.
Yeah.
Or have spouses who teach. Thank you.
Yeah. Sure.
It's a good thing the government sector is huge in Representative Bence's area, right?
It's like 25% of the employment.
Okay, then this slide just takes these four metrics and puts them all in the same spot. So we can see how the number are predominantly, in terms of number of businesses, the dominant player are the sole proprietors. The sales, the dominant player are the C corporations. And then when we get to income and tax, those are fairly similar, but it gets a little more even distribution between the pass-throughs and the C-corps, and then the sole proprietors are in third there in terms of the amount of income, taxable business income that they report, and then the amount of tax that they pay. So before jumping into statutory tax rates, here is a table that calculates just effective tax rates, and this is where we, for large categories, we look at the amount of sales and then the amount of income and the amount of tax and just divide one by the other. So these aren't statutory rates. We refer to them as effective tax rates. So for our sole proprietors, I'm going to talk about the effective income tax rate, and that's this column right here. And for the sole proprietors, their effective tax rate is 5.9%. That's just the tax that all of them, just throw them all into one bucket, the tax that they paid, divided by their income, that's 5.9%. For the pass-throughs, it's 9.1%. It's that same concept. And then for C corporations, it's 6.6%. So overall, for businesses in Oregon in 2014, the effective tax rate was 7.3%. One footnote to that is the pass-through entity policy that was passed in 2013 but didn't take effect until 2015. Now, we are getting to a point where we hope to get from DOR 2016 information on the impact of that policy, but right now our best information indicates that the revenue loss due to those preferential rates is about $100 million a year. So if I incorporate that, that's what this bottom row is. Now, the policy wasn't in place in 2014, but if I just take this 570 and reduce it to 470, basically accounting for that policy, in effect, assuming it was in place in 2014, the effective tax rate for the pass-throughs went from 9.1% to 7.5%. So, and then following up on the discussion from this past session, I've calculated the effective, kind of an effective tax rate on sales. if you will, for each of these categories. For sole proprietors, that would be 1.25%. So basically, to raise $207 million, if every sale that they made was taxed at 1.25%, it would raise the same amount of money. And then for the pass-throughs, it was 0.52%. And again, that's just taking the tax that they paid, $570 million, dividing it by the $109 billion in sales, and that turns out to be a tax rate of 0.52%. So that's equating kind of this effective income tax rate of 9% is roughly equivalent in terms of revenue raised to a sales tax rate or gross receipts tax rate of 0.52%. And then for the C corporations, that effective gross receipts tax rate is 0.27%. And then for the PTE, again, it's that same calculation where their 0.52 effective gross receipts tax rate is reduced to 0.43%. So those are kind of conceptual tax rates that help just inform the discussion, different ways to think about it. Before we get to the statutory tax rates, I have a couple slides here on the data that we use and how we get at this pass-through information. This is all reported on Schedule E. And as you heard me discuss earlier about the federal tax reform that's going on in place, there's this, at least at the federal level and in Oregon, there's been this distinction of passive income and active income. For better or worse, we've gone down this path of separating these two kinds of income. And again, active income would be if I'm involved in a business and I'm there every day, and the income I get from that would be active income, as opposed to passive income where I have some money to invest, my brother runs a business, I give him the $50,000, and then I just wait for that return to come back to me. I don't have anything to do with the business. That's passive income, and it's really more akin to an investment. And so that we're seeing policies play out at the federal level. Back in 2013, there's a 3.8% tax on this net investment income tax. There's a threshold, I think, for example, above $250,000 for joint filers, and that helped. That was one of the fundraisers, one of the revenue raisers in the ACA. And in Oregon policy, that's the PTE rate. Now, when we look at the Schedule E, we have all of that. All of this income is subject to taxation. About 86% of that income is represented on these pass-through entities. When we separate it, and this is new from what I had before, when we break that out for the S corporations and the partnerships and look at this active versus passive income, there's much more passive income on the partnerships. So for the S corporations, about 7% of that income was passive income, 93% active. And on the partnership, it was about four times the amount of passive income in percentage terms. 28% is passive and 72% active. Now, whether or not 2014 is a representative year, I don't know yet. I only have 2014 data for this, so I haven't looked at this over time to know how that's changing.
Well, is it possible that's related to the typical organization of partnerships with a general partner and a bunch of limited partners?
It's likely to be that, Mr. Chair. I'm working with the Department of Revenue, really delving into the data here, and looking at partnerships. We're getting some information on the number of partners involved in a partnership, and a lot of partnerships involve two or three people, and those are probably what you would think of as kind of a day-to-day business. But there are partnerships with 500 or 1,000 or several thousand partners. And those are really probably going to be the investment vehicles as opposed to actively involved in a business. And so I have no reason to think that this is unusual. I just wanted to, just because of some of the discussion here, I don't know that about this point yet.
Well, an S corporation is limited to a certain number of owners too, isn't it?
An S corporation can only have 100 shareholders.
Right, whereas a limited liability, a limited partnership could have a lot more than that.
Thousands.
Yeah. I don't believe there's a limit on partnerships with a general partner and a bunch of investors who are limited partners. There's no limit on the number of limited partners.
I don't believe so. I'll confirm it. I don't think so. there are the limits on the types of shareholders and partnerships. Right. But the partnerships are much more flexible entities. Okay, so jumping to the statutory tax rates for C corporations, we have this, didn't do very good differentiating the colors, but this bottom line here is Oregon's corporation tax rate. And what we have here is the tax rate, the marginal tax rate here on the y-axis, and then the amount of taxable income here on the x-axis. So, for example, for Oregon, the first $1 million is taxed at 6.6%, and then every dollar thereafter is taxed at 7.6%.
Okay.
So that's what that would look like. The chart, I just to try and come up with something that was visible, it's limited, it's truncated at about $1.2 million. There's nothing magical about that. Just wanted these steps to be seen. At the federal level, the first $50,000 is taxed at about 15%, then the next chunk of money is taxed at about 25%. And that's how the marginal tax breaks work. I still get the occasional question about whether or not people should take a raise because they get pushed into a higher tax bracket. And it's really just the additional piece of income, and not all of the income is subject to that higher tax rate. And this is what these marginal tax rates look like. And this top line is just the sum of the federal and Oregon tax rates. And then this piece is for business tax rates for active income. So for Oregon here, it's not the 5, 7, and 9 point percent. I've graphed here just to try and make the chart not too busy. These are the 7, 7.2, 7.6, up to 9.9% rates for active income of pass-through entities, since we're focusing on businesses here. So that amount just ticks up ever so slightly throughout this 1.2 million. And at the federal level, these are the personal income tax rates. It start off at 10% and then goes up to 15, and then 25, and then 28, and so forth, all the way up to 39.6%. And then this is the combined rate. So that's just a visual of the marginal tax rates. And then the last two slides are slides with a lot of numbers, and we get into an example of how some of this plays out for the different types of entities. So for a sole proprietor, on this one, I have a sole proprietor, a pass-through entity, and a C corporation. So the sole proprietor, the sole proprietor, we have one taxpayer, and they have profit of $1 million. So at the federal level, there's no business entity tax. They are subject to the personal income tax, and that $1 million of profit puts them in the 39.6% marginal tax rate for a tax of $295,666. And what I've assumed here are a joint return, two kids, average itemized deductions, and so forth. And so that translates into an effective tax rate of 29.6%. In Oregon, there's no business entity tax. They pay the personal income tax. Top rate, they are in the 9.9% bracket. That's about $90,000 and an effective tax rate of 9%. So combined federal and state for the sole proprietor, they have $385,000 of tax, which is an effective tax rate of 38.6%. Now for the pass-through entity, I've assumed a partnership or an LLC with two partners. Combined, they have $1 million of profit, and it's split evenly between the two taxpayers. So their tax is $230,000. Now, they're only in the 35% top marginal tax bracket because they have $500,000 of income and not the million. And so between the two, their tax is less at the federal level because they're both benefiting from their own deductions. And in Oregon, there's a $150 minimum tax, and then they pay $71,000 in Oregon income tax, and this is the pass-through entity rate. So they are in the 7.2% bracket for the pass-through entity rate. And then the $71,000 divided by the million, you get to a 7.1% effective tax rate. And so together, if they were structured this way, federal and Oregon tax combined would be just under $302,000 for a combined effective tax rate of 30%. Now, if we look at the C corporation, so it's just the corporation itself, we have one taxpayer, the $1 million of profits, and basically just shifting the how the entity is structured. They pay the federal business income tax, they're in the 34% bracket, so that's $340,000. And they're at the top of our 6.6% bracket, so they pay $66,000. So combined, that's $406,000 for an effective tax rate of 40%. So if we have this hypothetical business, depending on whether it's a sole proprietor, a pass-through entity with two partners, or a C corporation, we get three different scenarios of what their tax would be. So the last slide I have gets at the C corporation dividends tax and the so-called double taxation. So what we have in the last slide here is the C corporation. This is the information from the prior slide, the $1 million profit. And so they have $1 million of profit. They pay the federal and state tax of $406,000. So then they have dividends of $594,000. So under, I have two scenarios, scenario one and scenario two. Under scenario one, the $594,000 of dividends is split up between their two shareholders. You have an individual and then a tax-exempt entity. And all kinds of entities can own shares of stock. You can have, for example, a pension fund. You have a lot of large institutional investors who are tax-exempt for what given their structure. So, and this is important in thinking about the double taxation and how dividends are taxed. So in this case, this corporation has two shareholders, an individual and a tax-exempt entity, and they've split it 50-50. So each of them gets $297,000 in dividends. And at the federal level, the individual, they're paying a tax rate of 23.8%. That's 20% for the dividend tax rate and the 3.8% on the amount above $250,000. So basically 3.8% tax on $47,000. That's their net investment tax. So together, that's $61,000 in tax for an effective tax rate of 20.6%. And then in Oregon, because it's a dividend, it's just regular income for us. It's taxed at 9.9%. They pay $22,000 in tax, and they would pay $84,000 in federal and state income tax. And that's an effective tax rate of 28.3%. So the tax-exempt entity doesn't pay any tax. So the combined effective tax rate for these two taxpayers is about 49%. That's basically the $83,000 here divided by the $1 million. Or the $594,000.
So let me make sure I understand. Dividends paid to a tax-exempt entity, where I assume we're talking about a 501c3,
it could be a charity.
Charity.
Yeah.
Could be a charitable foundation.
Right.
I suppose.
Right.
But dividends payable to them are not taxable.
Right.
Now, income that they generate through a for-profit business that's a subsidiary is taxable to the subsidiary, isn't it?
Right, that's the unrelated.
And which, of course, is what we're dealing with here. In effect, the C corp is in effect a half-owned subsidiary of the tax-exempt organization. Thank you. I'm getting it into my head now how this works. Okay, thanks.
And then scenario two is just a different, this has been a topic of how much of these dividends actually go untaxed because the entities who receive them aren't taxable. And so there was a recent article in the National Tax Journal that came up with a way to estimate that. And so this split here is based on that scenario. So rather than a 50-50 split, it's a 30-70 split. And so the math just falls through. I won't go through all the math again, but that all falls out. And then the key point here is the effective tax rate is 45%. And that really has to do with the tax-exempt entity owning more shares or a larger amount, a larger share of the corporation. And so when we talk about all of the discussion around tax reform and the double taxation, it's important to keep in mind who are the entities that are receiving the dividends and whether or not they are subject to tax, because the amount of that, those dividends that go to tax-exempt entities really affects the calculations for these effective tax rates and how much that double taxation really comes into play.
Question? Yes. So yes, please.
Do we know what the cumulative impact is of this is? Do we know how many corporate dividends go to tax-exempt entities, or what the...
I don't think we have a handle on exact, like, it'll depend on the tax-exempt entity and which shares, where they make their investments, and a lot of that is private information. The research that I've seen, they kind of back into some of that information to get at some of these estimates. So it's not direct information. I guess it's indirect information.
Mm-hmm. But is it significant?
It seems to be. Hmm. I mean, and I haven't done a complete lit review to find out who disagrees and where the various pitfalls might be. But in this most recent research, I think the exact number they came up with about was 27%. And so I just used 30% here. Then that could be specific to a time period. There'd be a lot more to add to understanding how strong that estimate is. But this is an example and has all the pitfalls of an example. Okay. You know, it's kind of correct for everything that goes into it, but it's easy to deviate away from that and where it may not hold. But it's right. It just kind of putting numbers on a concept.
So if you're dealing with owners like this, an individual owner, a tax exempt that owner presumably at some point set up as tax exempt, my foundation, family foundation, or whatever it is.
Right.
I was thinking that it would be cheaper from a tax point of view to pay the owner, the individual owner, a higher wage and reduce your corporate income. But when you do that, then you can't pay the same number of dollars out to the foundation as a dividend, because you have to pay the owner his share of the dividend as well.
Right.
So, in fact, the individual here might actually make a great deal more money than the $300,000 you have in scenario one. But the rest of it would be wage income, salary from the corporation. But you wanted to make certain that the tax exempt got the $300,000 too, and that was the way you had to do it. Very fascinating.
So, and I set it up this way where the individual is not, I left quiet that issue of whether
right.
or not they're an employee.
It could be an individual who owns shares but has no other connection with the company.
Exactly.
And then, of course, you don't pay them a wage or salary.
Correct.
Right. Thank you. Other questions about this example? You see how complex this stuff gets really fast.
I know. Reminded.
And how understanding it becomes really important for tax policy. Paul.
Chris, could you go back to your share of key metrics? This is something that we've been talking about and thought of. So when you're looking at the proposals we had during your Joint Tax Reform Committee, it seemed to me that, well, particularly this last bar, it would be helpful to you to have this bar and then compare it to Plan A, Plan B, Plan C, and show how the distribution of the tax, you get a change in the total, but how the distribution among these entity types would change with each proposal. And that would give you a better sense of how these entities are affected. So that's kind of where we're trying to get to give you a tool to address that question when people ask you that.
And one presumes in that last example that you gave us, these things get set up the way they do to deal with all kinds of issues, don't they? With a state tax, with an owner's interest in a particular charitable activity, for business control. I mean, it occurs to me when you're talking about things like the Ford Motor Company with Class A stock and Class B stock, and I can't remember which is which, one of which has all the votes and is completely controlled by the foundation, which just happens to be controlled by members of the family. And all the other shares get dividends but no voting authority. All this stuff happens for a whole variety of reasons, some of which have to do with taxes and some of which don't.
And some corporations, I mean, it's there can be kind of an investment strategy for certain corporations that pay dividends and those that don't. They vote it. It's a philosophy. They're not going to pay dividends, and they focus on increasing the value of their stock.
Or you have no money to pay dividends with because you're investing it all. Right.
It really gets at a kind of the C corporations have retained earnings, and other entity types don't have retained earnings, which is where we got started on that pass-through entity tax rate a few years ago anyway.
Thank you. Very much appreciate the presentation. And I really appreciate, Paul, your pointing out to us this key metrics chart, because I think you're right. When you're considering business taxes, being able to refer to this chart and look at the changes that your proposal would make is one piece of data that would be useful in figuring out whether it's a useful proposal or not. Thank you. Shall we move on to personal kicker credit?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's our last item. And we now have in EOLIS, an official certification of the kicker. And that's was sent by a state economist on October 19th. So that's the first step. You know, he has given you what the numbers, and then what Mark has to do is go back through and look at it, his number he's got for estimated liability and the amount of dollars above the forecast for the non-corporate. That's the $463 million. And then he takes it and divides that by his estimated liability before credits, because that's what the statute reads now. And that's where he gets a 5.6% credit. And so he sends that to the department and to us and to LFO, letting us know that certification process. I've done a number of these memos myself, Mr. Chair, in the 90s, so I remember well.
Well, it is appropriate that the guy who does the estimate should be required to point out how far off he was.
That's right. More than 2%. Yes, that's just part of the humbling part of the job, yes. And then the other thing we have, and I just wanted to go through the first slide here on the kicker, and then Chris has got some distribution numbers for you. But just to remind you, and I think it is striking when you look at the revenue impact of the kicker over time, it's been triggered 10 times, and I have a calculation going what that long-term revenue impact is. And if for those periods where, for example, it was suspended in 91 by the legislature when it was a statutory, I included that in these estimates. And if you total all of those up, the times the kicker's been triggered on the personal side, the total amount to be returned either through credit or through refund was $3.7 billion. So that's over that entire 79 to 17 period. Now, if you add up all of general fund revenue for that period, and I've got a chart that I just keep summing that tab, that's 2.3%. So I would argue that's the average revenue impact of the personal kicker, is 2.3% of general fund revenue. And then it just happens that a weird circumstance is your $463 million kicker is 2.3% of your 17-19 budget.
I'm sure that's not a typo.
So that gives you a sense of what we're saying is this the average kicker impact. Now, it may be zero next biennium and then 800 the biennium after that, but it's going to average that 2.3% of general fund revenue over time, and the number will go up because 2% is obviously gets to be a bigger number as your budget grows, as your revenue, general fund revenue grows. So the other thing I'd point out, and Chris will show you the calculation, is to keep in mind that the kicker is not just personal income tax, it's most of it, but it's everything that's not corporate. So for example, of this $463 million kicker, over $100 million of that is caused by the underestimate of the estate tax.
Right.
So almost a quarter of that is due to the estate tax estimate. So, and Chris will go through the mechanics and just show you how we expect the distribution of the kicker to be.
So for the, and somewhat to refresh your memory on the details of how it's calculated, that's what this slide is. And so just to take a step back, we have, through all of the calculations, federal tax and so forth, we get down to Oregon taxable income. Oregon taxable income is multiplied by the tax rates, 579.9, and then you get to gross tax. And then from gross tax, you subtract credits. Income taxes paid to other states, the personal exemption credit, the earned income tax credit, all of those credits result okay. in tax liability. And this is the number that the state economist focuses on. That's what he forecasts, and that's what gets compared, the personal income tax piece of it. When it comes time to calculate the kicker, we, and I think DOR is going to give you more information on the details of this, but you go to the gross gross tax, you subtract the income taxes paid to other state tax credits, so you just subtract the one tax credit, and you get to what I call here the kicker base. And here, one of the tricky things about talking about this is that this isn't a concept that has a name. That's it. If you mention taxable income or gross tax, tax liability, those are defined concepts. But this doesn't really have a defined concept, so I've just labeled it the kicker base. And that kicker base is multiplied by the credit, the 5.6%, and that in the end is the kicker credit that somebody gets. So it's not multiplied by the gross tax or the tax liability after the fact. It's just this gross tax less this one tax credit. And that's part of what DOR has to deal or gets to deal with administering the tax program. So that's the minutia. And here are some estimated distribution tables. We don't have the details yet. It'll be when people will calculate this when they file their 2017 taxes. They'll go back to look at their 2016, and then they'll make these calculations. So this information is all based off of historical distributions, largely 2015. But from a straight-up AGI category, we have different income categories. And in total, we're looking at about 2 million filers and the average kicker about $229. I don't have it listed on here, but the median kicker is around $90.
That's it.
And you can really see how that changes. And it increases from low-income filers, the lowest of income filers, those with less than $10,000 AGI. Their average kicker is $7. And then for filers above $500,000 of AGI, their average kicker is just under $6,200.
To run a statewide campaign, though.
So the average is?
The average is 229. The median is about 90. 90.
Okay. I think in the future for this kind of a chart, you should definitely include the median as a separate number. I think it's really important for people to understand how skewed this distribution is, and that's the best way to describe it.
Yeah, that fair point. I'll keep that in mind next time. I did include the filers here, and so the median are folks like right around in the between 20 and 40. They're right down here, but that does require them people to do the math and adding up the filers.
So. I mean, one fifth of the taxpayers will get $8.
And the other
reduction
table,
in their 17 taxes.
Right. And the other table is a percentile. So the bottom 20%, the bottom 408,000 will on average get $8. And then the top 1%, there are about 20,000 of them, it'll be $4,600. So
great.
Those are just our standards.
Thank you. Are we hearing from the department?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, we asked the department to come up. As you recall, you changed the mechanism from back to a credit in 2011, and then the first time the kicker had been triggered since that change was following the 13-15 biennium. So department has one return season, filing season, based on that, and then they've learned a few things from that, and now they're preparing for the credit again on the 2018, the forms that go out from the 17 tax year.
Welcome.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Lois Williams with the Department of Revenue.
And I'm Ken Ross, also with the Department of Revenue.
So just as Paul said, we are currently in the process of getting ready for the 2018 processing season when people will claim this kicker credit. Just as a reminder, we're going to share with you some of the administrative issues that we deal with. First off, people have to have filed the 2016 return, and it's not too late. If they haven't done so, they can still file that return. There is no other mechanism for them to get the kicker. And they have to file a 2017 return in order to claim the kicker. Even if they didn't have a filing requirement for 2017, they're going to have to still file a return in order to get the credit. Now, in most cases, our processing system can automatically calculate the kicker, and we will adjust returns if taxpayers have failed to include it or if they've claimed the wrong amount. We can do all of that behind the scenes during our processing. But there are some individuals for whom we cannot calculate the kicker. We just don't have the right information. These are people who in 2016, for example, may have filed a joint return. They were married, but now they're no longer married. They have a different filing status now. And all of the information on the 2016 return may have been joint income. You know, one person may have had wages. They could have both had wages. We can track that down. But what if they had some of this pass-through entity income that Chris mentioned? We don't always have those details. So we can't automatically calculate it, but we can help them and give them instructions on how to calculate it. As was mentioned, we used to do checks, and now this is part of filing your tax return, and that can be confusing for taxpayers. But this is the second time around, and it was only 2 years ago. So what we are building upon is the comprehensive communication plan that we put in place last time. We had news releases that went out. We had messages on our website. And we used other communication forms, too, such as our practitioner updates. So we did a lot of communicating with this change because people said, you know, I used to get a check. Why don't I get a check anymore? And this is different. So we're building upon that. As a matter of fact, we already have information on our website about the upcoming season. We did develop an application called What's My Kicker? We used it 2 years ago so people could just go in and put their information in and it would come back automatically behind the scenes pulling the information so they would know what number, based on the calculation that Chris had up here on the screen, what number to put on their return to claim the kicker. And as well, we have instructions in the personal income tax and fiduciary tax returns for people to calculate. One of the issues
have to give you their 16 taxable tax, or did you calculate that, or did you draw that from the tax return they'd filed earlier based on the information they give you on the website?
On the website, they have to get identifying information, such as who they are,
right.
And then we can pull behind the scenes based on the data we already have.
Thank you.
In 2015, we were just moving the personal income tax program into GenTax, and we were doing some redesign of our forms. And this was the first time that the kicker was going to be on the tax form, so we had space issues. As a result, we moved the line that's customarily reserved for the earned income tax credit. We took it off of the main Form 40 series and moved it to a schedule where all of the other additions, subtractions, and credits can be claimed in one spot. We thought that would be helpful to free up room for the kicker. Unfortunately, that caused some confusion for people. So this year, we've brought the earned income credit line back to the main form as well as the kicker form. So we've done some redesign there. Each line has a dedicated amount that can go there. We did take a lot of calls. Obviously, this was new to people, so we tried to keep track. But overall, we only had about 1,600 calls into our call center that were directly related to the kicker. We do anticipate fewer calls this upcoming session for a number of reasons. For one, it was only 2 years ago, so it's a little bit familiar to people since we just did it 2 years ago. We've corrected that issue with having the earned income credit line moved. So by having each earned income credit and kicker have their own separate line on the main form, that will be helpful to people. As well, I mentioned that we had just moved into our new GenTax processing system. 2 years ago when we used our What's My Kicker application, we had to pull the prior 2014 data from our legacy system, massage it in the new system in order to give the data to people. Well, now the 2016 tax data is native to the new system. It's going to be less complicated, much more efficient for us to give them that information. We're continuing to do outreach, providing information, working with the practitioner community as well. So we actually anticipate having a better kicker season this time around. Is there anything you want to add, or we'll take any questions?
I would like to add one thing. One thing that we did, we're able to do with this new system is that we, because we have the information, we told folks that if they went back and amended their 2014 which changed the tax base for the kicker calculation, that they also didn't need to amend their 15, that we could do that for them. We have been able to do that. It was a little more complicated than we thought it would be. It took a little more time. The timing wasn't as good, but we're still looking at that as an option for this next time around.
Okay. Questions?
Thank you.
It looks like you've had the experience and are now ready to go with it for next year. Very good. Thank you for sitting here all afternoon in preparation for this report. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Colleagues, we meet next at the end of the month. Is it the 29th?
November 29th at 8:30.
At 8:30 in the morning, we'll meet with the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee in order to receive the revenue estimate. I do expect good-natured comments to be made to the state economist about the certificate we just received today, and the level of accuracy of his prognostications. but we'll see. Anything else? Thank you all so much. Please get any comments you have on committee bills to me or to Paul right away, because we have to put these in by next Tuesday, and I'm not going to promise to wait that long. Okay. All right.
Next week.
Yeah, Tuesday.
Tuesday is the submission deadline.
5:00.
Yeah.
And that means for your personal bills too. So.
Oh, I've got those all handled.
All right, great. And with that, thank you very much, committee.
We're meeting on Wednesday.
We are adjourned. You and I are meeting.
I know. Wednesday.
We are adjourned. You and I are meeting.
I know.
Committee.
We're meeting on.